Refuge in Bodhicitta. We'll do a few seconds, a few minutes of meditation, and then we'll do the Refuge in Bodhicitta. What? 34.
Yeah, so thank we're you. Going to do Refuge in Bodhicitta momentarily after we meditate for a few minutes. If you're using a gold prayer book, it's page 34-35. Yeah. If you are on Zoom, I will be pulling it up and share it on my screen when it's time.
Yep. So, let's just sit quietly for a moment and create a nice separation between whatever you'd had going on today or tonight, even this evening and up until right now. We'll start out just sitting up straight, feet on the floor, eyes can be slightly open, slightly closed, whatever's comfortable. And then start out with a few deep breaths, filling up your belly, filling up your abdomen like a balloon, and then exhaling, and then do that again. And just hold the breath at the top for just a moment, just a count or two. And then exhale, letting out all the dark energy, the anxiety, the whatever's going on that might prevent you from being fully present this evening. And then follow the breath wherever it's most noticeable to you. And if the breath doesn't work, you can use sound or even touch, like the feeling of your rear end in the chair or your hands in your lap. It's whatever works best for you to stay focused. But once you commit to it, your mind needs to stay stay with that object. And when the mind is distracted, which it tends to do, you gently but firmly bring it back to the object or the focal point of your meditation, your touchstone, whatever that is. Now scan your body, starting with your feet, working up the ankles to the calves, the knees, thighs, and so on, from the bottom to the top. Just scan your body for any areas that you might be holding on to tension. And if you see that, if you feel any tension, let it go. And then scan again from top to bottom. Another way to focus the mind is, count the breath. So with, as you breathe in, count one, and breathe out, two, and in three, and out four, and in five, and out six, and so on up to 10. And then when you get to 10, you start over again. And again, it's just, it's inevitable that your mind will get lost in thoughts. And if you just gently but firmly bring it back to the object that you've committed to focusing on. Just like, every time we bring it back, that's really the practice. It's like every time we bring it back, it's like doing a, if you're a bodybuilder, it's like doing a curl with a weight. Every time we notice that we've been distracted and we bring the mind back, we strengthen the power of our mindfulness. And notice how you feel now as compared to before we started the meditation. You might be more relaxed. You might be more uptight. That could be, doesn't have to be a certain way. And then relax your tension and we'll do the prayers on page 34 in the prayer book. And again, you know, generating, taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. So the first two lines, again, are about refuge and distinguish a Buddhist from a non-Buddhist. A Buddhist takes refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And the second two lines distinguish someone who's particularly on the path of the Bodhisattva. And so it says the practice of giving and other perfection. So we talked about those, you know, generosity, ethics, patience, joyful effort, concentration, and wisdom. Those are the six perfections. So, but those are the practices of a bodhisattva, a being who's destined to become a Buddha. So I'll do this, these together three times. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, May I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. And then the four measurables. The first one has got to do with great love. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. And then great compassion. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And then joyful, great joy. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And equanimity. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then we can do seven line prayer. The first line is the antidote to frustration is the antidote to pride. Okay, so very powerful practice doing prostrations because pride or ego, our egocentricity is our biggest obstacle. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. And then the second line is the antidote to our miserliness by practicing generosity. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. And declaring our negative actions is like the first step in purification. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time. And rejoicing is the antidote to jealousy. And rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And then the mandala offering, short mandala offering. Again, traditionally before teachings, you know, always offer a mandala to the guru, to the Buddhas, to the enlightened beings in the space in front of us. You can imagine that. And so we're offering up everything that's good in the universe. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun, the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radna Mandala Kamne Yatayami. So last week, I don't know, everybody could have gotten this online, the inner job description card. And I did this, well, I left it at my office, so I only did it 5 days, but I did it, and again, did it today. And I noticed that it's a good reminder, the bodhicitta attitude, I will think of others more than myself, I myself will make a difference, I will provide whatever beings need, I will respect the center rules and the five precepts. I'll never give up. I'll remember that samsara has problems, even when things seem good. But I'm not sure where these particular attitudes came from. Maybe Lama Zopa mentioned these things. And then, of course, the six perfections, trying to remember each of these and to practice every day. Generosity, ethics, patience, joyful effort, concentration of wisdom. Does anybody remember what it's written down here anyway. Joyful effort, delight in the good work we do for others and persevering despite obstacles and laziness. So that may be the most important one of all because Dharma practice takes effort. I mean, it takes to get results, this is not like electroconvulsive therapy, you know, where if you're depressed and really in a bad place or something, you know, you can get ECT and get shocked out of it. Even medication, you know, a lot of it works within a few weeks for depression, within a few minutes for anxiety. But this is not like that. This is very, Dalai Lama says, you know, don't look at your practice. Don't look at the success or failure of your practice in terms of like, you know, one little, you know, 5 or 6 week class. We're just planting seeds, you know, we're just like, you know, just planting seeds. And these seeds will ripen eventually, but they'll ripen a lot sooner if we do the practices that help to empower these seeds. So again, these 11 meditations that we listed, the very first class, those are things that at least begin to familiarize yourself with and be really, really excellent if you could memorize those 11 points and actually do a meditation based on those points. I have a few things. Wait, do you have a copy of that meditation, the equanimity? Not the equanimity, but exchanging self and others, those sheets that I handed out.
The one that you sent me on email?
Yeah.
Yes, let me see if I can grab that.
Pardon?
I'll see if I can get it pulled up.
Yeah, I think I've got it. I mean, I don't need it, but I don't want to confuse people either. We can do it. We can do this. All right, so we're going to do, you know, exchanging self with others. That was the other, you know, there were two ways to develop bodhicitta. One was a seven-point cause and effect, okay? And the other one is exchanging self with others. And the seven-point cause and effect, remember? Anybody remember? Repetition is not a bad thing. So the first thing we do always when we want to meditate on universal compassion, that is, like, leaves nobody out. First thing we need to do is meditate on equanimity and develop an equanimous state of mind. So we're not clinging to the so-called friends, and we're not feeling aversion and pushing away and feeling hatred and so forth toward the so-called difficult ones or enemies. And then the vast majority of people that we feel just total indifference toward, that we call strangers. So that's not going to get us, that's not going to help us develop this notion of universal compassion for all beings. So we really have to make some effort to develop an equanimous state of mind where we feel, have equal regard for all beings. And the easiest way to do this is to imagine, and by the way, sometimes in the Theravada tradition, you know, they talk about equanimity, but it's just a more stable mind. But here we're talking something quite a little different. It's maybe a lot different, where we're trying to develop equal regard for all beings. And so for the so-called friend, when we're remembering that all of these labels are merely labels, and they're ephemeral. They could change any moment. One moment, the friend could become the enemy. The enemy could become the friend. All strangers, all of our friends and enemies used to be strangers. And maybe some of our former friends and enemies are now straight, back in the category of strangers. So there's no fixed label, friend, enemy, and stranger. But we tend to reify these labels when we're around certain people. And it causes us to discriminate. And what we want to have is equal regard. And then the other thing is to remember that They all are just like I am. They just want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. It's just so simple. It seems simple, but it's not. It's very profound. The Dalai Lama always starts his talks out, probably in the first sentence. He'll say, just remember, we're all the same. We all want happiness, and none of us wants to suffer even the slightest bit. So we just, we're all the same. So when we do those kinds of contemplations, and it could be expanded and so on, but we try to loosen the attachment to the friend, and we feel some, we actually care about and have some regard for the strangers, and then the so-called enemy, the person we feel aversion toward, we want to let go of that aversive mind, and again, equanimity, equal regard for beings. Any meditation it's easy to have compassion for the people we love, our close and near and dear ones, but the vast majority of people, would not qualify for our compassion. And if anything distinguishes Tibetan Buddhism from other forms, any other spiritual practice in the world, it would be the attitude of universal compassion. And equanimity is the solid foundation for developing that mind. All right. So then the seven cause and effect. So the first of those was seeing all sentient beings as having been our mother, which is not only in this life, but in past, and again, will be in future lives. And then remembering others' kindness. You can remember the kindness of your mother specifically. If that works for you, we certainly can remember the kindness of others in so many different ways. I mean, just the food we eat, the clothing that we wear, the electricity, the computers, even this body, this that we call mine is really not my body. It was a gift my mom and my dad sperm met and created this body. So it's not even my body. It's due to the kindness of others. And so on. We can think in those ways of just how others have been extremely kind to us. And then if it works for you to think about your mom in this life and the sacrifices and that she's made, for you to be able to be healthy and have a good life, an opportunity to have a good life. It's been said without the vigilance of at least one adult, most of us wouldn't have made it past the first year of life for sure. I know some people swear that they were raised by wolves, but no, human beings, mothers and fathers. So remember their kindness, and then we think of repaying their kindness, right? So this is, this is sort of a natural fallout of having done the first two meditations, seeing everyone as having been our mother, a close kin, best of friend, whatever it works, and then remembering their kindness. And the next step is sort of natural. It's, I must repay that kindness. It's my job to repay the kindness of somebody else. It's not your job. It's my job. It's my responsibility. And then meditate on great love, which is this heartfelt love that again springs forth. It sort of comes forth from having done the other meditations. Well, we naturally have this thought. Actually, there are three ways to think of it, as particularly from a Bodhisattva's perspective. The first one is how nice it would be if you could think of, and also think of maybe, you know, one person. You don't want to start out with universal sentient beings and all in human form. That doesn't really resonate. I mean, that doesn't move your heart very well, very much. So you might think of one person in your life right now who's might be, you know, who you want this particularly, you really want them to have this experience of great love. You think, you know, how nice it would be if they could have happiness and the cause of happiness. And then think, may they have happiness and the causes of happiness. And then I will cause them to have happiness and the causes of happiness. So that's quite different, isn't it? I will be the cause. That's the Bodhisattva's pledge. I will be the cause for this particular person to have happiness and the causes of happiness. Try to feel the meaning of those words, not just say them, feel them. Feel it in your heart. In compassion. Again, you know, wouldn't it be great if everybody could be free of suffering and its causes? And again, but let's think of one person now. One person right now that you think, that you can think of. Could even be yourself. Could imagine yourself, but think, may, you know, how nice it would be if they could be free of suffering and its causes. And then think, may they be free of suffering and its causes. A little stronger, isn't it? A little more powerful. May they be free of suffering and its causes. And then I will cause them to be free of suffering and its causes. I personally will cause them to be free of suffering and its causes. Which then leads us to the next step in the development of bodhicitta is this supreme wish, you know, that I am personally responsible for the happiness of, and we can start out with one person because we need to make it real, not some, you know, pie in the sky kind of thing. I'm personally responsible for, you know, guiding this individual, all sentient beings, from their, wherever they are, in their current state of confusion and suffering, to supreme happiness, supreme enlightenment, by myself alone. As Lama Zopa says, by myself alone, I am responsible. My big plan is to guide all sentient beings from suffering to supreme happiness, to the supreme happiness of a Buddha by myself alone. That is my vow. That is a bodhisattva's vow. A spiritual warrior. Sounds crazy. Sounds like it's impossible. But it's an attitude that we must, if we're going to walk this path, if we're going to make progress on the bodhisattva path, the Mahayana, this is kind of an important attitude to have. And then, of course, the next step is developing bodhicitta. So the goal, once again, is to liberate beings from suffering and its causes and establish them in the highest of all happinesses, which is Buddhahood. You know, and so that they have perfect wisdom, perfect compassion, perfect power, perfect, skillful means. All those essential qualities that we think of as the qualities of an enlightened being, a Buddha. It's like, you know, that's who we have to become. That's what we're aspiring to be. Our goal is to liberate all beings from suffering and establish them in the state of full enlightenment. And our method is our own enlightenment, is eliminating our faults and developing our own qualities until we become a Buddha. So, again, totally motivated by compassion and loving kindness, not any sort of ego, not some ego attitude. Well, that's the seven cause and effect meditation. Any questions about that before we move on?
If you do have questions or comments, remember if you're on YouTube, you can put those in the chat box. And if you're on Zoom, you can raise your hand or unmute or put it in the chat as well.
I think I'm going to, before I go into this next meditation, I want to talk about really important subjects. Like I said, compassion is the real key. It's the key thing in Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism in particular, great compassion. And this is from a book by Jeffrey Hopkins called Cultivating Compassion. I'm not going to find it. So I'll just have to wing it. So there are three kinds of three types of compassion. But the first one is compassion seeing, and this is based on a teaching by Chandrakirti, who's some great Buddhist scholar from many years ago. The first kind of compassion is seeing beings that are qualified by the three sufferings, right? That we talk about this almost in every module, I'm sure. You know, we talk about essentially the first noble truth of dukkha, that the truth of just the suffering of being miserable, right? The suffering of misery, the suffering of changeability, and the suffering of being caught in this process of uncontrolled causation called samsara, where we're, you know, day after day, you know, lifetime after lifetime, you know, we have no idea what's going to happen to us even in an hour, in a minute, even in the next minute. We don't have any guarantee. Tomorrow, to be sure, there'll be problems tomorrow and next week and on and on. So, you know, the first kind of suffering, and it's obvious suffering. And then the second one is the second kind of compassion. And we can develop compassion by just thinking of ourselves and other beings caught in this whole process of not only of the misery of change, and the misery of pervasive suffering is what we call it. We try to develop some compassion. When we recognize suffering, we try to use that as a way to develop compassion. But as I said, if we don't feel connected to people or beings, then the compassion doesn't arise when we see suffering. In fact, even happiness or joy could arise seeing our enemies suffer might actually cause some kind of perverse happiness. The second compassion is seeing beings as evanescent, qualified impermanence, and insubstantiality. So that means that we're all in a process of change. It sounds very much like the second of the three types of suffering, but you know, we're all caught in this process of uncontrolled causation, always in a state of flux. Never for a moment. We're always getting older. Things are always breaking down. Things are always in a state of change, of flux. And we don't like that. We want things to be stable. We want things not to change. We find the right relationship, or we find the right job, or the right whatever. We want it to stay and be stable, but it's not like that. Things are always in a state of change. And then the last third kind of compassion is seeing empty beings qualified by not having any, this is Jeffrey Hopkins' language, by the way. The third kind of compassion is seeing empty beings qualified by not having any apprehensible signs of inherent existence. Well, what does that mean? So let me say a few things about this. So Chandragirti uses an example for the first kind of suffering. It's like a bucket in a well, and the bucket kind of, it's much easier for the bucket to go down, just like it is much easier for us to go to the lower realms than it is to get up. But, and then the bucket's banging against the sides of the well and clanging and all of that kind of stuff. And so they use that as the image. It's first kind of, so we are sentient beings that are qualified by this kind of suffering. You know, like this bucket in a well, where it's much easier to go to the lower realms. You know, we all have pain and suffering. It's always changing, and we have no clue what's queuing up next to cause us to be miserable. And the second one is this evanescent kind of this compassion based on seeing things as impermanent, changeable, and insubstantial. He says it's like looking at like you got a bucket of water and the wind is kind of blowing at night, and so the little ripples in the water, and you can see the reflection of the moon, but it's really kind of, it's not clear. And you use that, that's the example in meditation that you can use to remind you of this particular kind of, you know, that beings are qualified by being impermanent, by all of this constant flux. And eventually we're there's not only subtle impermanence, which we can't see, but gross impermanence, which we can see by just looking at pictures of ourselves a couple of years ago, or even when we were younger. So gross and subtle impermanence. And it causes a lot of suffering. And then the third kind of suffering, and the cause of us to develop compassion, is to see, and the image is the it's like the moon on a still lake. Like, and this had this is referring to emptiness. So if you are looking at water on a lake, and the moon is reflecting on the lake, you look in the water and you think, there's the moon. But you know, you know it's not the moon, but it looks like the moon. You think it's the moon, but you know in your heart of hearts, it's a reflection of the moon. So we don't grasp at it. We don't see it as the real thing. So this gets back to the whole thing of how in the world does compassion arise from a realization of emptiness? Well, you know, I've heard His Holiness say this, and I know Jeffrey Hopkins I remember him specifically saying this one time, that that one of the key ways that a realization of emptiness actually Well, let me back up and say this. You know, Geshe-la teaches emptiness a lot on Sundays, doesn't he? He talks about the I, this sense of a false sense of self that the ego projects, and then we cling to it, and it causes all kinds of problems, and we can't find the I, it's not in the body, can't find it in the body, we can't find it in the mind. The mind's made up of these aggregates. There are five aggregates, one is the body and the four mental aggregates, you know, discrimination, compositional factors, consciousnesses, and there's a fourth one I can't remember, but it's all about mind. Those aggregates are just the body and the mind. So, you know, we can't find this I in the body or the mind. We even talk about it. Like there's an owner, we say, oh, my body, my mind, don't we? We say my body and my mind, like there's an owner. What is that I that is, see, this is a key part of, this is the key to successful emptiness meditation, by the way. What is it? What is this I that seems to be the owner of the body and mind, this sense of a reified, real, inherently existent I that seems to be permanent, seems to be so, you know, like I said, reified, hardwired. We use terms like inherent existence or true existence. That I that seems, that's the I that we are talking about. That is completely, is a complete fiction. It's a complete mistake. And it's based on that I that we get caught in and all the problems come. The anger comes because this I gets offended. The attachment comes because this I wants something. You know, the pride comes when this sense of I gets all puffy and so on. So all of the negative killing and stealing and adultery and lying and slander and harsh and frivolous talk, greed and hatred and ignorance, all the 10 non-virtuous actions are all predicated on this misperception of I. And when we understand emptiness a little bit and we look around us and we see that everyone is caught up in this misapprehension of reality, all of the suffering that we see around us, and you might have trouble buying into all of it, but the Buddhist assertion is all of suffering is based on this misapprehension of who we are and how things exist. And it's because of that that all of the suffering from the beginning of beginningless time until now is the cause of that one mistake, that one fatal mistake. And it causes us, when we understand that beings are caught up in a world that's basically a fiction, projection of our minds based on karma, right? Our karmic projection creates our view of reality, and we believe it, and we respond to it and react to it that way, and it causes all of our problems because we don't see things truly the way they exist, which is in empty of that inherent, reified, solid, independent existence. It doesn't, things don't exist that way. They exist exactly the opposite way, but we don't see it that way. And so a Buddha, for example, you know, feels enormous compassion just because that's a Buddha's nature, but also a Buddha can see how sentient beings are drawn in to so many kinds of problems and suffering because of this one mistake, this misapprehension of reality, where we see things as being truly existent when in fact they don't exist that way. How do they exist? Independence upon causes and conditions, independence upon the various parts that go into making them, and independence upon a consciousness that labels them. The most profound meaning of emptiness is understanding that things exist in dependence upon a consciousness that labels things existing a certain way. So we can see compassion, which is, you know, crucial here in the development of bodhicitta. There's, you know, good reasons for us to feel compassion for everyone, not just our near and dear ones, but all beings caught up in this fantasy world and believing in it, and then getting sucked into incredible misfortune because of that, and actually perpetuating some sorrow, all because of this misapprehension, what we call ignorance. So if we can do the meditation on exchanging self with others. So we'll start out, we'll just do, I'm not going to get through all of it tonight, but we'll just do some of it. So we'll start out with, this will be good. So we'll start out with equanimity, right? So that's always the first step in developing, our attitude of universal compassion or bodhicitta, where we have attitude of universal love and compassion for all beings. And and one of the first meditations in this is basically seeing at least the equality of self and others, right? That we all want to be happy, don't want to suffer. But this is how Jeffrey Hopkins' book, he's saying, this is the Dalai Lama's favorite meditation. So maybe worth paying attention to this. He says, this is taken from the God to the Bodhisattva's way of life. Imagine that, so that you're imagining yourself, I'll give you the quick version of it. Imagining yourself as the wise person here, but then you're imagining also yourself as being this kind of deluded, selfish, mean, nasty, me person. And over here, imagining like a handful of really poor, impoverished people who are destitute and suffering nonstop. You know, and so that's the quick version of it. This is the more elaborate version. Imagine that you are better, more relaxed, confident, and wise self is in the middle, looking at two sides in front of you on your left and right. Imagine your selfish self on one side, the person who's pushy, is trying to get an earlier flight or a piece of cake or something like that. This person who's just thinking of himself or herself, remember an incident, a recent incident or play act, convincing instance of your nasty, cruddy self thinking, I, me. Not that usual self, but a nasty, self-serving version of you. Okay? You just see that version of you over here on the left side, let's say. Across from yourself, imagine a group of destitute persons, poverty-stricken or in pain. Then in the middle, looking at the other two sides, is your wise, discriminating self. You look out to one side where your cruddy, selfish self is, utilizing any of a variety of examples. And then he goes on to say, His Holiness asks the level-headed you in the middle to reflect on the fact. The selfish I on one side and the destitute ones on the other side equally want happiness and don't want suffering. And then the question is, who will I help? My selfish self or the destitute people? Just imagine it. As the wise one, you're asking yourself, which side am I going to help? The selfish one groveling after his or her own welfare, or these destitute people? Let's just think about that for a moment. Just do a 1 minute meditation. Both sides want to be happy. You know, you want to be happy. Your sort of bad version of you wants to be happy. And all of these other beings, who are really countless, all want to be happy. Don't want to suffer. Which side are you going to help? And then the Dalai Lama, his conclusion is, there's only one of me. Others are infinite in number, exemplified by these 5 or 10 destitute people that we imagine, but others are infinite. We think of others as being like, you know, one, but others are infinite, you know, countless beings. How could the welfare of the infinite larger group not be more important? So in this meditation, really, we're being asked to see that others' happiness is actually more important than our happiness. It's kind of hard for me to, a lot of people, it's hard to even imagine that. But when you think of it this way, you think of it this way, that others are so, you know, infinite, and there's an enormous amount of suffering. And I'm just one selfish, you know, sort of self-centered being. All of a sudden, we can at least open our minds up to the fact that others' happiness is at least as important as ours. And again, we come back to, you know, we all want to be happy. And none of us want to suffer. So their happiness is at least as important as ours. And then we meditate on the false self. And this is really, I think, you know, maybe one of the more important meditations just from practical day-to-day living, is to see the false of the self-cherishing, selfish mind. Okay? And without getting too technical here, it really is about the ego. It really is about selfishness. And Buddhism is quick to point out that it's just selfishness, this sense that I'm the most important one of all. I mean, other people, you know, I care about it, but, you know, what do they say? Our most powerful instinct is survival, right? That's all about me. It's all about me. And there's nothing wrong with that attitude, but the antidote to this self-cherishing attitude is actually bodhicitta, developing bodhicitta. The antidote to this sort of the root of samsara, which is self-grasping ignorance, is emptiness. So that's slightly different, but similar. Okay? So here we're just taking a look at all the things that self-cherishing, selfishness, you know, again, you go back to the 10 non-virtues, you know, self-cherishing, selfishness, with that attitude, killing and taking what doesn't belong to us, stealing and sexual misconduct or adultery and lying, deceiving others and slandering and bad-mouthing others and harsh speech. And wasting people's time with idle gossip and greed and hatred and ignorance and the other 84,000 delusions all, you know, come from one mistaken attitude, this sort of self-cherishing selfishness. So, you know, that's the demon. That's the real devil. Lives in our heart. And then cherishing others is the cause of all happiness. So we're going to flip side of that. And again, Lama Zopa, I really challenge you to think about this. Is it true that cherishing others is the cause of all happiness? Well, from a karmic perspective, makes sense, at least in terms of the actions of body and mind, body and speech. If we cherish others, we wouldn't kill them. We wouldn't steal from them. We, you know, our sexual We wouldn't harm them in any way sexually. We wouldn't lie and deceive them. We wouldn't badmouth them, you know, harsh speech, disturb their peace of mind, and waste their time with frivolous idle gossip. It's very easy to see that if we cherished others, we wouldn't do any of those things. We'd do the opposite. We'd save lives. You know, we'd speak the truth. We'd save lives. I'm thinking of the opposite of killing. You know, we wouldn't kill. We'd save lives. We wouldn't steal. We'd be generous. We'd give things away. We'd support. We'd do whatever was necessary to help others. You know, in terms of sexual misconduct, there would be integrity in our intimate lives and not the opposite. And then if we cherished others, again, we'd speak the truth. We wouldn't lie. We wouldn't slander them. We'd speak well of them, at least focusing on their good qualities. Everybody has some good qualities, you know, and so on. So you get the point. So self-cherishing is our, you know, big enemy here. The self-cherishing selfishness, and cherishing others is the source of all happiness. And we thought, you know, we live in a country and actually in a world where basically you're told to look after yourself. You know, you better look after yourself because, you know, if you don't, nobody else will. And, you know, it's all about me, me, I. I mean, the I generation, right? We're all in the I generation. Let's take care of me and I. And Buddhism's saying, big mistake. You got it all wrong. Cherishing others is the way to find happiness. Cherishing others is the way to find happiness. And actions that spring from that attitude of cherishing others. Okay? Now, the next step is exchanging self with others. Now, what does that mean? Exchanging self with others. I've heard it explained a whole bunch of different ways. So, but you know, the simplest way to think of it is that we're exchanging self-cherishing, which is our default mode, for an attitude of cherishing others. So now, up until now, our default mode has been cherishing myself. But now we're gonna give that up, and we're gonna cherish others. We're gonna cherish others. And so when it says exchanging self with others, sometimes it's explained that now when we see others, we think that they're like me. We think that other person is me. And I need to take care of me, them. What do I want them? I want to be loved. I want to be accepted. I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. Right? So we need to practice exchanging self-cherishing selfishness with other cherishing. And we see all the problems that we get, that we've had because of not actually even, we never even knew that this attitude was possible. But it is possible. It's possible to actually develop this attitude of exchanging cherishing for cherishing others. It's possible to develop that. And then, you know, part of the way to do that is to, again, we meditate on love and compassion. We meditate on love, again, how nice it would be if they could be happy and have the causes of happiness. May they be happy. And again, it's really important to not make this so wishy-washy. I mean, I don't know if that's the right word, but make it so indiscriminate. Like, to really take real people in your life. And a lot of times it helps to start out with yourself, particularly if you're practicing Tong Lin. It's good to start out with yourself. So you may think, you know, how nice it would be if I could have happiness and its causes. You know, wouldn't that be nice? May I have happiness and its causes. And I will cause myself to have happiness and its causes. You know, may you have happiness in this cause. Oh, how nice it would be if you had happiness in this causes. May you have happiness in this causes. I will cause you to have happiness in this causes. Again, Bodhisattva attitude. I will cause you to have happiness in this causes. I will help you to see your truth and create the causes. And you yourself will create the causes for you to have supreme happiness, even enlightenment. Again, compassion. Wouldn't it be great if I could be free of suffering and its causes? You know, may I be free of suffering and its causes? I will cause myself, I will create the causes for myself to be free of suffering and its causes. And then reflecting out, how nice it would be if you could be free of suffering and its causes. May you be free of suffering and its causes. And I will cause you to be free of suffering and its causes. Kind of wild. So you know, each time it gets a little stronger. May you, how nice it would be if I will cause. So may you have happiness. May you have love. May you have compassion. I will cause you to have love and compassion like that. And then here's where, and we'll do this next week, because next week we're going to spend a lot of time doing Tonglen meditation, we'll review these points again, and then we'll using the breath, we'll imagine, first we'll start out with ourselves, and we'll imagine that we're taking on our suffering, whatever it is, depression, sadness, despondency, fear, whatever. Whatever it is, you know, health issues, we imagine. And we imagine as we breathe in, we'll be taking that negativity in the form of black smoke and destroying our self-cherishing attitude and filling us full of light. And we'll send that light back to ourselves, wishing ourselves to have, you know, imagining that we have good health, peace of mind, freedom from fear, freedom from all kinds of destructive, harmful, negative states of mind. And we imagine that we've actually achieved that. And then we work with somebody else that we love, somebody that we're close to. And then we work with, you know, maybe a couple of people. If you have time this week, it's great to do this meditation with as many people as you can. Then you go to the stranger, the person that, you know, at Starbucks that hands you your coffee wherever you are, just a faceless stranger that we don't really have any regard for. Usually we feel indifference toward. We imagine the same thing. We, you know, take their suffering and give them happiness, what they want and need. And then gradually, we can work up to the people we feel aversion toward. We're taking on their suffering, you know, their pain, their negative karma, all of their problems. We imagine we take that into our heart, destroying our self-cherishing, selfish mind. It's like a rock, a black rock at our heart, explodes it like a meteorite hits it, and then we're full of light, and we send back this light, this healing light of love and compassion to our worst enemy. You know, maybe right now you don't like Vladimir Putin, but there's probably some people that in your real life that you have similar feelings of aversion toward. So we want to work with real people in real life situations as much as possible. And then from there becomes a supreme wish, and there, bodhicitta, like that. So that's in a nutshell. But our homework this week is to do the do this, these practices. It was passed out, exchanging this meditation on exchanging self with others and evolving into developing, resulting in the generation of bodhicitta. So again, they were, and then the following week, we'll combine these two traditions again. Remember, we talked, the first class we did those 11 meditations, and we'll combine all 11 of those in the last class and maybe spend more time on Tonglen, the taking and giving practice, because that's so powerful. Any questions before we wrap it up?
So again, if you do have questions, feel free to raise your hand. If you're on Zoom, put it in chat. If you're on YouTube, if you're here in person, we do have a question here, Don, in person.
Yeah. What is it?
Actually, do you mind speaking in the mic so that the folks online can hear you, your question?
Yes. My question regarding cherishing others.
A little bit closer.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Regarding cherishing others and not cherish yourself.
Didn't say that.
Okay. So what? So what is it that you stated in that regard?
Pardon?
Can you clarify that point then? If I misunderstood.
Yeah. I mean, there's. It's not that, you know, and I sometimes the word cherishing is a little awkward in this situation, because we think cherish is something precious, right?
Right.
Well, we do, you know, we do have compassion for ourselves. We're using these meditations to sort of to help develop a state of mind that's the antidote to all of our problems. Okay, well, right now we have, we cherish ourselves to a fault.
Yes, I agree on that.
Okay? That's the problem.
Okay.
And it's that self-cherishing that causes, when I say, when somebody points a finger at you and calls you a bad name, and you go, you know, what is that? Why is that? Why did you react that way? Why do we get upset? Or when we see something that's, looks delicious and desirable and we have to have it. You know, all of this is coming from this self-cherishing attitude. This is the Buddhist point of view, is that this is a mistaken perception about how we exist. We do certainly exist. You know, there is an I, right? But what is it? The Buddhist, again, this is not even Buddha, this is just a fact. There's a body and a mind. I don't think anybody would argue with that. And everything is in a constant state of flux. You know, change. The body's changing moment to moment. The mind's changing moment to moment. And yet we say, we feel, oh, there's an I right there. But wait a minute, it's already changed. That being doesn't even exist anymore. We're caught in a state of constant flux and change. You know, emptiness, which is the ultimate reality that Buddhism talks about, is another story.
Okay.
Good question. Thank
Just
you.
To resume, so practically, in a way, is that I'm not being selfish and just cherishing myself, but in a sense, well, because that's the problem. But in a sense, what I'm trying to do is kind of have like an equal cherishment for myself and for others, and in that sense make the importance of stopping suffering as equal for myself as for others.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, we talked about, the Dalai Lama says he tries to do this meditation, you know, when he has his sort of ordinary kind of self-centered yucky self over here, and then all these destitute people over here, maybe 10 or 15 real people, though. They symbolize infinite other beings. And then he says, who's more important here? These 15 people over here who are destitute and having trouble, or this selfish, self-centered person. And logically, you say the 15 were. We don't have a problem right now. I mean, obviously, we're not going to give up on ourselves. But our default mode is to want to take care of this one, whereas we're trying to train ourselves to cherish others more than ourselves. And we're probably, but really the goal is to cherish all beings equally, and we're part of that.
Gotcha.
Right?
Thank you.
Thank you. Good question. All right. So we've got, I appreciate everybody showing up. And lots to talk, lots to think about. And if you still have this, I challenge you to do this week. I did it today again. Was disappointed a couple of times at myself when I realized that I'm not doing that great, but I'm doing okay. So let's do the dedication prayers, Shanti Deva's dedication prayers on, I think, 34, 32. Where is it? 32. Oh, yeah, 32. All right, Shanti Deva's dedication prayer on halfway down on page 32, where it says, may all beings everywhere. All right. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food, may the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, as weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Amen. Okay, so we'll see you next week. And your homework is really to do the meditations on exchanging, using the meditations on exchanging self with others to develop bodhicitta. That would be and I would encourage you particularly to pick real people in your life to work with, not these all sentient beings. Doesn't really get it for many of us, does it? I mean, I want to become enlightened for all sentient beings. Well, that sounds great, but also let's maybe start out with our children and our loved ones and our coworkers and the people in our communities. And so make it real that way. It's very important to not make it so eerie theory, you know, this, so, you know, make it real. That's where the benefit comes. All right. Thank you.